Good. We will get this committee underway. This is the Friday, May 8th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Transportation and Public Safety Policy Committee. Members, we have two matters in front of the committee. We're going to hear about the Upper St. Anthony Lock and Dam closure and a proposal to make some grants to businesses that will be impacted by that closure. That's Senate File 1552. For the opportunity to raise the issues, opportunities, challenges that this step that has been taken by Congress presents to our communities and these businesses. And don't quite know the path at this point, but it's important to get these issues out on the table for the public record and for some discussion. And then we'll hear at the request, and I hope Senator Newman will come, because he specifically requested that we take a look at the fair compliance issues that were raised a little earlier this year. Yeah. With that, Senator Metzner, welcome. Thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you very much for accommodating us this late in the session, Mr. Chairman and members. As you mentioned, Senate File 1552 deals with the Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam Grant Program and Appropriation. If you don't mind, I'm going to kind of work off the summary that your staff did. I think they did an excellent job, and you're smiling. See, they very good. But Bonnie and Krista, it looks pretty good. But Section 1 creates the Upper St. Anthony Lock and Dam Closure Grant Program within the Transportation Economic Development Area. This is sometimes called TED, and it deals with adverse problems with the adversely affected companies in the area that are affected by these programs. The program is exempt from statutory criteria and process associated with TED program and administered by the Commissioner of Economic and Development, their DEED. DEED Commissioner will review the grant application and the order received and the award grants to the eligible applicants within 60 days. To be eligible for a grant, the business must be located upriver of the lock and dam, operate a commercial navigation facility, and use commercial vessels on the Mississippi to expedite commodities movements. Grant awards are for the relocation, redevelopment, alternative transportation methods, and mitigation of increased cost. And Section 2 is the appropriation of $40 million. So this is a very severe problem for the companies in this area, particularly in the economic area, and we just feel that there ought to be some compensation for this. And I know it's going to be an ongoing kind of a discussion, Mr. Chairman, but I have some witnesses that have their businesses in the area, and if you don't mind, I'll call them up to the table at this time.
Very good.
Jack Perry, Northern Metal Recycler, Steve Ettinger, and from the aggregate industries, Bob Berouge. You say that, would you? That's a tough one.
Bob Berouge.
Okay, that's great. So if we go from there, if that's all right.
Very good, yes. So whomever would like to kick it off, just please introduce yourself, and then you can begin your testimony. Thank you very much for being here this morning.
What do you want?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Steve Ettinger from Northern Metal Recycling. I think to summarize, we've testified in the House before, and I think to summarize what the situation is, Northern Metals acquired four companies in about 2006, 2007. We aggregated about 15 recycling facilities in three states here, and we built a central shredding facility on the river in Minneapolis, where the material all flows to that central shredding facility. We shred, we process there, and we ship by barge. We also have rail service, but I would say probably 85% of our material ships by barge. Because of the St. Anthony Lock closure, essentially, when the river closes in June, all of that material is going to have to be transferred from Minneapolis to St. Paul. So we have a river terminal in St. Paul as well. So our choices are really two: either transfer all that material by truck to St. Paul and load it in barges there, or potentially relocate that facility We built that facility 5 years ago. I would say its life expectancy is probably 30 years. Unless we can receive compensation that would pay for relocation, our plan would be to continue to operate where we're operating and transfer those trucks from Minneapolis to St. Paul. It's essentially where we're at.
And how many trucks would it take to replace the barge?
For every barge that we load about one barge a day. It's about 70 additional semi-trailers.
That running, would go, Mr. That, Chairman, running up and down our streets to get through Minneapolis to get to St. Paul.
It would go through the I-94 corridor from Minneapolis to St. Paul. So we probably handle about 200 trucks a day right now through that facility in Minneapolis. So we'd be adding in the neighborhood of 1,000 trucks a month additionally going from Minneapolis to St. Paul to the terminal.
Thank you. Questions, members? Just so I understand Mr. Ettinger a little better. The metal, the scrap metal comes to the facility by truck, but then leaves the facility after it's been shredded by barge.
About right? 85% leaves by barge, correct.
Okay, very good. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, if I understand correctly, this lock and dam closure is as a result of the Army Corps of Engineers has control over, do they not?
I believe that is correct.
Senator Metzen.
And, Mr. Chair, are you looking for any kind of compensation from the federal government or the Army Corps of Engineers for the loss of this business?
I'm going to ask Senator Metzen. Council here for where they're at on that. Is that, would that be all right? Not sure.
Yeah, believe me, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just,
No.
This
no,
is
I,
a federal issue also,
question,
I think.
I don't know the answer, but maybe. Okay.
Mr. Perry?
Yes.
All right. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, Jack Perry from the Briggs Morgan Law Firm. There is zero chance that the federal government or the Corps is going to pay for this. And in large part, it's because neither the federal government nor the Corps was necessarily in favor of this. This is an initiative by folks in Minnesota, Minneapolis, some consortium, we're not quite sure whom, based upon this perceived threat of Asian carp. And that was the justification that was given. But it was not a federal initiated project. And so, we have some lobbyists in D.C. who have explored that issue. Zero possibility of.
So this was done by an act of Congress, and I believe the I don't know if we have the language of the federal law, but the short version is the federal law says we encourage state and local units of government to perhaps find resources to assist the affected businesses in the area. So they just basically passed the buck. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I rather assumed that that was the answer that I was going to get, but I had to ask the question. To anybody that might know the answer, is there a precedent for this? What do we do if the DNR or the Army Corps of Engineers decides to close down Lock and Dam 1 or 2? I mean, how many businesses are we going to go to be on the hook for in the future if we set a precedent in paying for this business? I mean, where it feels like we're going to pull at a string, and I don't know where it's going to stop unraveling. So those are the thoughts that are going through my head. I have no idea what the answers might be. But I would be very concerned about Pandora's box being opened by this bill.
Right. Did you want an attempt at an answer to your question?
If there is one.
All right.
My first question, is there a precedent for this? Oh. And my second question, then, Mr. Chair, and you're as good at this as anyone, what are we going to do with this in the future if we're going to close down, you know, another lock, or perhaps a business is affected by the federal government on something other than the river?
Mm-hmm.
Is the state of Minnesota going to go on record setting a precedent of reimbursing businesses for actions of the federal government?
Excellent questions. I don't quite have any knowledge of the second part, and that it does beg a very, very worthwhile policy discussion. I'd say the answer to the first part of your question, just kind of shooting in the dark, and I can't quite give you precise instances, but just generally I know that it varies quite a bit, depending on a whole bunch of random substantial circumstances. For example, I know that in Minneapolis, when we had a series of pretty dramatic rain events over a period of months in the summertime of 1997, and we had localized flooding that occurred repeatedly, which really gave rise to a greater awareness of the inadequacy of our stormwater sewer system, the system that carries water away from places where people live, and also highlighting the fact that post-World War II, when Minneapolis had undergone a tremendous amount of development pressure because of just a lot of families building homes and starting their families, and so a lot of places were built up in low-lying areas that maybe shouldn't have been, but there's just so much pressure to build houses. It became apparent that two things needed to happen. One was the storm sewers needed to be right-sized, adequate to the task to handle these events that seem to be occurring more frequently, and these kind of low-lying, what had been wetlands throughout Minneapolis, these kind of catchment areas for acres around, needed to have the houses eliminated and stormwater detention ponds be put in place. And there wasn't really a direct rationale to literally buy folks' homes, because when there's this kind of overwhelming public purpose, but because it was that those sets of unique circumstances, there became a kind of a nexus and a rationale. People were bought out, their homes were replaced, and they were able to be made whole so that we could do these stormwater detention ponds in about a half a dozen areas. In other instances, I know that Senator Senjum can talk about the Red Wing store that was heavily impacted by public infrastructure. And I don't know, you probably weren't a part of the many years deliberation. We finally got a little bit of a fix. And Senator Senjum, you're going to have to give us a report on whether or not Red Wing shoe store down in Rochester's business has returned to its previous levels. But what happened was Highway 52 was built, you know, to kind of interstate standards, and noise walls were put in, and an exit ramp was installed. And what had been, this is kind of a large flagship destination type shoe store down in Rochester. And people would be driving along the highway and they say, oh, look, and they'd have time to identify it, find the exit spot and go buy some shoes. By the time they were aware under the new situation, they were well past the shop itself, and the owner came in and provided a fairly compelling argument that this was a bad thing. And so we didn't purchase and replace the location of the store, but we did at least get some signs to forewarn the traveling public that this awesome store is about a half mile down the road and you should think about getting off on the next exit and going and buying some shoes there. So it varies. But the real question I think you ask is, when another unit of government takes this action, what is the local responsibility?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, part of what went through my mind is you know, this is a fairly small number, but just for instance, we know that there are some pretty stringent EPA regulations coming at us from the federal government regarding emissions from coal-fired electrical plants. So just humor me here. What if those regulations by the federal government are put into effect, and suddenly we find on the Iron Range the steel manufacturing plants can't come up with enough electricity to operate their plants in an efficient manner, and they come to the state of Minnesota and say, you got to reimburse us. Mm-hmm. Now you're talking real money. Mm-hmm. And so I when I say you're going to pull at a string here and you don't know where it's going to end, that is what's going through my mind. This is really a sad situation for this particular business, and I do recognize that. But my goodness, where do we stop? Mm-hmm. If we are going to begin reimbursing businesses by reason of federal action, I don't know if we can afford it, is what my concern would be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And listening to you talk about the situation in Minneapolis made me think about that there probably are a lot of precedents when you think about towns that have been basically relocated because they damming up rivers to create energy sources and that kind of thing. And so, you know, it would be interesting, I think, to consider different types of situations that have happened in the past and how those have been responded to. I mean, I think about, you know, University Avenue over here when they were building the Green Line and, you know, accommodations were made to support local businesses as much as possible during that disruption, you know, so mm-hmm. the thing we deal with, but right. as you say, kind of on a case-by-case basis, I imagine.
Right. Thank you. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment before I get to my question, I'm thinking, you know, there was a day when I-94 came through the Twin Cities brand new, and I suspect an awful lot of property was taken out of existence, and I don't know. I'm just going to expect that there was probably some enumeration for that loss of property and house and so on and so forth. I think that's fairly typical with transportation. But my question is, do we have any sense of river traffic? Might there, for instance, be... like, how long is the list? Are there grain elevators in Little Falls or Brainerd that ship down river now, or and would also need some accommodations if we do this, or other recycling companies or whatever? I mean, how big might the list be? And I don't know how far up the barges go, so I may be.
Senator, I think this is as far north as the barges go. I don't think they travel right. much farther north. The river gets pretty narrow and pretty shallow north at this point.
Well, shallow barges can. I don't know.
Oh, really, really shallow.
just
Senator
like,
Metz.
I'd like to add, I think, on the theme of Senator Newman, that this is going to cost the company at least $4 million more a year to transport. And it's no fault of theirs. They didn't do this. And, you know, they didn't make this decision. The city of Minneapolis and others did. So it just seems to me that eminent domain or something should kick in. I mean, $4 million a year for the next 30 years, you know, and they didn't do this to themselves. So that's part of our argument.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the discussion here is rather substantial in that recognizing that in this area of transportation, this is there is precedent for this, and I think that's constructive and also very helpful. The one thing I think in clarifying, though, my understanding, though, is, yes, this was an act of Congress, but it was requested by Minnesota. Both groups are two U.S. senators, congressional delegations, several members. And so I think there was a meeting of the minds in the sense of the Asian carp and the whole situation. But I think to just say Congress just did this to us without any involvement with us in Minnesota talking about this, and I think that's the nexus for us here in Minnesota that make a difference, at least for me. But nevertheless, Mr. Chairman, if there is more trucks, maybe this would be the time to have our 90,000-pound weights come along at the same time.
Excellent.
Nicely played.
Nice save,
oh, except,
Senator Jensen.
We do have the interstate constraint still. We need to fix that at the congressional level. We've got the 80,000 restraint constraint on our interstate systems. But I like that we don't miss the opportunity. A quorum is present. So we've had a nice discussion already. But we have more people to testify. Senator Metzen, who would like to go next?
Would you like to?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senators, I'm Bob Buragel with Aggregate Industries. Aggregate Industries, formerly the J.L. Sheely Company, some of you will probably recognize that name, just last year celebrated 100 years of operations in the Twin Cities. Just an aside, just a little bit of history. Even before J.L. Sheely was formed in 1914, his father James Shealy delivered the marble to this building from the railroad station nearby. So in 1905, he helped to build this this very structure. You'd also know us, so you probably know the Shealy Company, but you'd also know us as the barge guys that run up and down the Mississippi River carrying sand and gravel and crushed rock. Joe Shealy started that business about 60 years ago in the mid-50s. Since then has transported material in downtown St. Paul. And then when the upper and lower St. Anthony locks were constructed in Minneapolis, Shealy then opened a distribution yard in the mid-60s between the upper and lower St. Anthony locks. And so for 25 years or so, material was running into downtown Minneapolis as well. So for the 50 or so years that 50 and 60 years that Shealy has been running material into these downtowns, excuse me, something in the neighborhood of 50 million tons of sand and gravel have come into the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And in that 50 to 60 years, virtually every major project in these downtowns has been constructed with our material and with our business partner, Samstone's Concrete. So you have the I-35W bridge, now the Viking Stadium, the Gopher Stadium, et cetera. The list is quite long. It's that river system, which is, you know, which is a significant part of our business that is impacted by this lock closure. As I said, for 60 years, this company has relied on that river system. That river, we have two mines located in the Pine Bend of the Mississippi River south of St. Paul. Both of those mines are large volume mines. Both of those mines were located there specifically because of the ability to take material from those mines onto the Mississippi River and into the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The road system that accesses those properties is not adequate to actually run a mining system out of that out of those locations. So the mines themselves, the distribution yard, one in St. Paul, one in above the upper lock in Minneapolis, are there because of the river. The one above the locks in Minneapolis is there because of the locks. And so we have, in the last 60 years, built our business, expanded our business, improved our business based upon those locations and based upon an assumption that we would be able to finish the reserves on those two island mines another 15 or 20 years, that we'd be able to bring material via this most efficient delivery system known into the two downtowns of Minneapolis. You heard that the lock closure is federal, is a federal law. It will close on June 9. Largely promoted by local interests, and largely promoted at the notion that at some time in the very near future there might be carp moving into the central lakes of Minnesota. A lot of the experts, excuse me, will tell you that it's probably something like 20 years before a breeding population of carp get up into this part of the state. So you'll get experts on both sides of that issue. So whether or not that's the truth or not, the truth is the locks are going to close, and the whole notion was we're going to close the locks for the greater good of the people of Minnesota, and we're going to do that on the backs of these two companies. And so we would very much like to see some assistance from the people of Minnesota, from the state of Minnesota. The grant program that's before you, that is part of this bill, would provide some money for relocation, would provide some money for the infrastructure required for us to make the adjustments from barge to truck, and it would also provide some assistance for the ongoing operational costs that will be, in our case, 15 to 20 years. So appreciate very much your support for these two companies.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you. Senator Metzen.
Maybe Mr. Jack Perry, what's the...
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I should have. I know how that goes.
I'm tunnel vision
see,
right now.
See people.
I have eyes
waving.
Only for Senator Metzen.
So I'm looking, Senator Metzen, I'm looking at a handout that's dated 5/7/2015, and on the second page it says there are currently three businesses that utilize the upper three locks, and that's correct. We're talking about three businesses. And then it's recommended that the state should immediately pursue negotiations with these businesses with the goal of reaching agreements that compensate them to voluntarily discontinue. Are you saying that that's not going to happen, or so you have to pursue something through deed? Who would normally, and somebody can answer, who would normally pay for something like that if there were negotiations?
I'll have Mr. Ettinger tell you his plans for his company.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Ettinger.
In response to that, the fact that the river is being taken away from us, it's the same situation as aggregate. You know, we set up our business. We have 15 recycling facilities that's the epicenter of the business. It would not be a situation where we would go out of business. I think quantifying in our case, the additional transportation cost for us is about $3.5 million to $4 million a year in direct auditable costs, in addition to what we're doing now to transfer material from Minneapolis to St. Paul. In addition to that, we've already spent about $4 million on infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, rail cars to move material into our facility so we can free up our fleet of about 100 trucks to transfer material from Minneapolis to St. Paul. So those are quantifying some of the numbers I think is important. That $3.5 to $4 million per year in additional transportation costs, that will never end. That will continue from year to year because our only option will be to ship on the river, and we ship steel mills downriver in the United States, several of them, by barge. So we'll have to transfer that material there. We will not go out of business in contrast to that, or I would say in the opposite of that, is that we'll have to incur those costs starting next month, those additional transportation costs. And unless we could receive compensation that would pay for us to relocate, we've invested about $200 million in our business since 2006. So unless we were compensated to be able to build a new plant, and I think forward what is perhaps a larger agenda for redevelopment of the upper Mississippi, we would continue to operate where we're operating probably for the next 20 or 25 years. So there's kind of a larger picture that comes into play. But having built and spent the kind of money that we've spent 5 years ago to build that new state-of-the-art plant, it just wouldn't make sense financially. We wouldn't be able to do that unless we were compensated.
All right.
Fine.
Thank you. Who's next, Senator Metzen?
Mr. Perry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Perry from the Briggs & Morgan Law Firm, and I think the easiest way to understand this is to put it into legal terms. This is a garden variety takings, but it's done by the federal government, which makes them exempt, so we can't go out with them.
Perry, can you just move the microphone over closer to you? Thanks.
But the federal government, and get to Senator Kiffmeyer's comment, she's spot on. Is the senators from the Minnesota delegation who were pushing for this were well aware that they were not going to get congressional support to pay for this. And so they put a very specific note, which is unusual, in this bill, and it reads, and it's important because it gets right to the heart of this, is they anticipated this was a Minnesota issue, and it says, the concerns at the upper St. Anthony Falls lock and dam are unique, not representative of other projects on the nation's inland navigation system, and should not be used as precedent for agency determinations on other projects. And here's the key line. The managers support efforts at the state and local level to mitigate potential economic impacts of this action. Everybody understood these impacts. No one has disputed that. No one can dispute that. And this was a unique Minnesota issue. Everyone recognized it. As to Senator Newman, you raise a great concern. Is this a bad precedent we would set by trying to help these two guys out? Because they're the only two businesses that are affected. Are you setting a bad precedent yourself? Well, if locks and dams were closed on a regular basis, I'd be more concerned. But this is a subset of one.
very, very unique, very unusual this took place, very controversial. These don't happen. This is a unique situation, and unique in that there's only two affected businesses. As to Senator Jensen's comment, I'm not sure that we responded to your comment. Your question was, and that was a note that was presented before, is how do we resolve this thing? And you've heard from the two companies that they're going to incur millions of dollars each year in additional transportation costs. And so the task that they've had and what they've tried to do with this bill is to figure out, can they find a way so it's not an annual extra $4 or $5 million a year? And both companies have been very, very aggressive trying to do that because their transportation system is being taken away. And being on the river is no longer necessary. And that river property is very, very valuable for other interests, and they could now relocate. The problem is that to relocate, and we'll just use Steve, his company, Northern Metals, as an example, to relocate is a massive undertaking, one that he would lose lots of time and labor costs and economic costs. It's probably a $30 million cost just to do it because he'd have to rebuild the entire facility. It's a $100-some million facility, tear down the old one, and then move that one elsewhere in the country. Steve is not going to do that on his own. It's never, ever going to happen. And so what we came up with is, what is a number that would justify him incurring that? Not going to make him whole. You will never make him whole. It's just never going to happen. He knows that. He's a big boy. But what is a number that's reasonable that would incentivize him to actually do it? And we have monetized that at $20 million. That's what it would take to incentivize him, and we've cleared that all the way up through the channels in Britain. It's a British-owned company. And that's what they need to do that. And I think, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think you're from Sherman County area, that's your district. One of the sites they're looking at is to move, there's an entire shredder, to a site in Sherman County that actually wants this facility. And instead of being a river-oriented business, it would be a railroad-oriented business. So they are trying to find a way to accommodate this, and not to be made completely whole, but to find solutions. And that, I think, is what you're asking, Senator Jensen, is they are working very, very hard to do that. They've had several meetings with the city of Minneapolis, several meetings with various legislators trying to figure out ways, and different governmental bodies trying to find ways to solve this problem. Aggregate Industries has as well. They've looked at different sites. They have to use the river because that's where their material is. Different places to relocate, that's going to be a hard, difficult task, but they're certainly open to doing that. And that's what this request is about, is to honor what the federal delegation said in their notes when they passed this, is that we got to find a solution to these people. Because this is, I guess, back to your comment, Senator Newman, this is not like a regulatory issue where you have to come into compliance, I don't believe. This is stripping away your access. An entire business is built upon this transportation system. If this was 35W and access was removed, there would be compensation. You cannot have a company that, in case of Aggregate Industries, was relocated by the city of Minneapolis south of this lock and dam to go north, and now that river system's taken away. It just is. It defies common sense and fairness to say these people should just have to absorb a $4 to $5 million a year hit, particularly when they're coming before you here saying we're going to try and find solutions that won't make us whole, but will help a situation and maybe improve the entire river corridor. So that's the request, is to work with you folks and give a pot of money that will help them to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Perry, do these businesses have an eminent domain claim against the state of Minnesota, even though it was federal law that is closing the lock and dam?
If they do, they've gotten bad legal advice from me, because I don't think they do.
Thank you. And I'm sure you wouldn't give them legal advice. At least not admit it.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Perry, just getting back to Senator Sinjum's original question about, you know, looking upriver. So you represent both of these companies?
Correct.
And this is the entire universe of companies that are affected as we're discussing?
That's right.
Okay, just wanted to get
If they're
that.
Out there, they've not surfaced.
Okay, so. And so I just wanted to clarify that. And, I mean, I think sort of to what Senator Jensen was saying, and I mean, I don't think anybody here is saying that, you know, there's forget it. No, you know, I don't think that's the tenor here at all. But I do think there's a question here of, you know, what's going to happen in that area if you guys are going to relocate or however that's going to work. Minneapolis obviously has a big interest in what's going to happen with that part of their city. And it just seems like there ought to be a more global sort of forward-thinking approach if Mr. Ettinger's company relocates. You've invested in that facility. That can be bought. Who knows? You might make money on that deal in some sort of different.
Senator, I believe they rent the property.
Okay.
That's actually a question that I have. I mean, I don't know that anyone has the answer, but if we're going to put this much money in relocating a major industrial facility,
right?
We don't want another major industrial facility to take its place. So,
exactly.
So if this is going to happen, it would be pretty important that that property be repurposed.
Which is exactly my point, that, that you know, this type of discussion, I think, should probably be part of a bigger conversation that involves the city and the plans and, you know, find the financial resources that exist and make the most out of it and then figure out what's still missing and do what we can to make these companies as close to whole as possible. But
Right. Did anyone want to attempt a response? Was that a question, Senator Ken?
It's just a more of an observation in response to what Mr. Perry was saying. That this is one approach, but I think this is a more complex issue that involves a variety of parties, and they're not all at this table. And so, you know, that seems to be
right. Yeah, I understand that it's the Isaacs family that was the original owner of the metal. A recycling facility. They sold the business, but retained control of the property.
Okay.
It would be pretty important for the property to change hands so that it could be, so its use and purpose could change. That's a pretty important threshold issue for me as a representative of Minneapolis. So did anyone want to respond to Senator Kent, and or do you have further testimony, Senator Metz? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, first let's see if there's a response to Senator Kent, and then we'll go to Senator Jensen.
Mr. Perry would like to respond to Senator Kent.
Senator Kent, you are correct. It is highly complicated, and that's one of the problems. If we wait until all the pieces are together, then, you know, we'll all be retired. So the other difficulty is that The idea of repurposing it and taking that property is different than what we're proposing here, is that the lightning rod of these two properties has been formerly referred to as the Condorator, which is a brand name for a metal shredder. That is what is being discussed being that would be moved for Steve's business. That entire, it's a $100-some million facility, that would be relocated to another site if these monies came. But as far as the existence of a metal scrapyard and the sand and gravel operation there, that would still exist there. But the major lightning rod has been that the Condorator, and that would be what was moved.
But Mr. Perry, part of the argument is that all these trucks, et cetera, et cetera. And so if we, you know, if another different, whether it's metal scrap or some other heavy industrial operation just springs up in its place, that rationale goes away.
No, good question, Mr. Chair, is what would happen? 80% of Steve's trucks go with the Condorator. I'm sorry, I know he hates Hector. Anyway, they go with the metal shredder. Mm-hmm. And so what the whole idea of this, because we've had lots of discussions addressing that very point, is if Steve's trucks go out to, let's say, to Senator Kiffmeyer's district, goes out to Sherburne County, then 80% of those trucks go, And that roughly equates to the additional trucks that aggregate industries bring. So we're at a net gain. So it's a wonderful solution as far as the local traffic and even the traffic to St. Paul. So it does address that and purposely does. That's one of the reasons why we pushed Steve to do that. And the other issue on, if this is an idea where governmental body actually wanted to take these two properties, then it wouldn't be a $40 million ask. It would be $200-300 million ask. It's very, very expensive if you want the whole operation in that property. And that we have not put on the table because there's presumably no appetite for that. That's why we're keeping it focused on what we have.
My point still stands. Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify what I was really asking. Because do we consider this lock and dam part of our transportation system? And who normally pays for our – is this committee responsible for that area as part of our transportation system? Because what we're talking about is redevelopment and other things, but the cause is from an immediate – they're going to lose – part of their transportation system that they've been using as of June. So this impact is going to be them right away. So my question was, will this $40 million going through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, or should we be actually having who is responsible, and that was my question really, is MnDOT responsible for stuff that happens on a transportation system rather than DEED? And shouldn't they be doing that right away? And I don't know if anybody can answer that. But that's my main question, because if we're the Transportation Committee and we're responsible for looking at the transportation issues, they're asking you to not use the transportation system. They're not asking you to leave. They're just asking you, is my understanding, they're asking you to voluntarily stop using that transportation system that you've been using, and it's going to create a huge cost difference in what you're doing right away in June. So I'm glad I have the opportunity to hear about this, but I'm just wondering what's going forward with this. I mean, what are we going to do to try to help this as a transportation committee?
That's what we're trying to sort out here and get the issues out there out on the table.
Thank you, Mr.
And,
Chair.
And it's not entirely clear because there really isn't precedent for DOT to do this sort of to do this sort of takings or sort of respond to this, what was being characterized as a takings in this kind of unique set of circumstances.
Okay.
I mean, if MnDOT was building a new facility, through the heart of this operation, yes, absolutely, it'd be clear as a bell. But it's not quite clear in the circumstance. Okay. So let me see. I have an order here. I have Senator Carlson, Senator Kiffmeyer, and Senator Newman. We do want to get to the discussion on fair collection, and I know that the GOP is caucusing in this room at 10, so we need just to, oh, they're not. We can talk as long as we want. All right. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first one, I guess, is for Mr. Perry. You mentioned that you weren't sure if there were other businesses that were affected. Is there no marinas upstream? Has there been pleasure boating? Have people looked at the logs of the locks to find out if there's going to be some people that are not aware that this is going to be closing, that they will come out of the background as soon as this happens?
Our due diligence says
Mr. Perry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I've been a little bit lax. I do have to call on folks, and they have to address comments to the chair.
Yeah, my fault. My bad. Mr. Chair, we have done due diligence to assure ourselves that these are the only two affected businesses. Others have done that same due diligence, but I can't say 100% certainty because I haven't personally done that, but others have done that. So we have zero fear that there is someone else going to come out of the woodwork, but I just can't tell you I have personally done it. Others have done that.
Senator Carlson.
Yes, and then my follow-up question, which I'm not sure who to ask, but just to make the statement, is that we're really talking about something we're asking the federal government to do because of fish. It's more related to fish, and it's the fish that want to go upstream as opposed to fish going downstream, and also, you know, we're looking at other states where they have a problem with salmon going upstream to breed. You know, there's some relationship to natural things that happen. Are we doing as much as can happen? And also, I see in the write up here it says that all deterrents should be deployed in downstream locks such as 19 in Keokuk, Iowa. You know, is there an estimate of whether that's going to be successful? If it's successful, will this lock open up again? So are we talking about something that may, you know, and I guess I don't know if what constitutes temporary in people's minds, you know, if it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you know, if this can be resolved elsewhere, is it going to open up again? Because if it's closed forever, then these people are going to be affected forever. But if there's some alternative there that's going to make a difference, and if the resources that we would otherwise put into accommodating, you know, going around the problem might be put into resolving the problem, I think that would be better for even a greater population of businesses. And if it goes the other way, are we going to be closing locks downstream? The Minnesota River runs by my district, and there's no locks and dams to prevent the same fish from going up the Minnesota River, and so, you know, there's dangers there too. You know, I don't want to change this committee hearing into an invasive species hearing, but that is what we're really talking about, is we're doing this because of fish.
Well, Senator Carlson, I don't have the answers for you. I would, but Senator Tomasoni chairs the Environment Finance Committee. He has all the answers for this. Senator Tomasoni,
and no money.
So, I do, if I'm not mistaken, this is a law of Congress, and I don't think it anticipates that this lock ever be reopened. I think what it anticipates is the lock is shut and decommissioned permanently. I don't know about the other measures that are being attempted downstream, electrical barriers or those sorts of things. But there is, you know, there is the example of the collapse of the Missouri River and other rivers, because of invasive, or not the Missouri, but the Ohio. I think the Ohio River has had an ecological collapse attributable to Asian carp. And so there's a lot of fear that the same thing will happen. And we can dispute, you know, whether it's perceived. I think Mr. Perry used the word perceived. I think that minimizes the level of scientific concern. It is a real threat. The fish have been found up in our neck of the woods, as well as other kinds of biological evidence of their presence already up in this area. And so it's coming. They're coming. And they outcompete everything else. And then once they get into the upper lakes areas of our state, there is a discussion about the decline of walleye on Lake Mille Lacs. We'd have that problem multiplied by hundreds. So I don't anticipate that this lock will be reopened at any point. But I don't have the definitive answer, so we'll have to go elsewhere if we want the word. So, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I really appreciate the fact that there could be a business in Sherburne County, and we would welcome that situation, though.
Right. Usually room 15 gives us a lot of grief. I don't know. We all right.
Farther. Okay. So I think that the issue for Sherburne County, again, as a road, we already have a huge amount of pressure, and increasingly so as a of transportation. And while we appreciate that your corridor has its issues in regards to the increased truck traffic, shifting it to Sherburne County, we welcome the business side of it, but there is those kinds of
things that go along with that, and already our rail, very, very heavy, and our transportation. But I do know, in having those conversations with Sherburne, that we've seen this coming and that sort of thing, and that as we go along the way and see some accommodations for making that traffic flow more smoothly, that will be helpful. And so we will be active, and I think that is the purview of our committee, and you've heard of that before. I think one of the things that is important to me here, because there is a nexus with the Asian carp and some of that, and I think, Senator Thompson. Lost him. He must have seen me coming. I think that with water, Asian carp, and some of those things, this could be a shared funding source for this, because it isn't just exclusively a transportation issue.
Yeah. Well, Senator Kipper, if I may interject, TED is a joint DOT deed program. So,
yes.
And both agencies put dollars into the TED program.
Well, I think DEM and so on, but I also think that there is legacy dollars that mm-hmm. was for the purpose of water, Asian mm-hmm. carp, and other issues. So I think absolutely we should also see this as beyond TED.
But also take a look
at those legacy dollars as well.
Very good.
Thank you for that.
All right. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to direct the question to you because I don't know where else to go with it. Reading from the coalition letter, the reason for the closure of this lock and dam is the fear of causing irreparable harm to our rivers, lakes, streams that support an $11 billion a year recreation and tourism industry in Minnesota. Given the reason why the lock and dam is going to be closed, have legacy funds been explored as a possible source of funds rather than the general revenue, and has the idea been discarded or simply not looked at, or is there a possibility?
Senator Newman, I don't know the answer to your question. Maybe Senator Metzen knows.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the answer either, but I think it's an excellent question. Why not look there like Senator Newman and Senator Kipmeyer are talking about, and I think that's an area that could be explored here. It certainly is water. And,
all right.
Well, let's take a peek at that, I guess. That's right. Why we're here today, I think, bringing all the issues we could think of up and put them on the table. But, I mean, it's a serious problem, and we've got to look under every rock and try to help these people. I mean, again, it's not their fault that it happened, and they should, in my opinion, get some relief, you know. Really.
Very good. All right. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I sense we're about concluding this, but as I think about this, and maybe at least initially from like 10,000 feet and trying to create a logic trail, and I sort of go to this idea that, to me at least, the river is a commercial highway as much as I-94 or I-35 or Highway 52. And when we take through remodeling, reconstruction of the concrete highways, when we deal in that way, we usually make businesses whole that we affect. And so my little logic trail takes me to this river highway and the fact that on these occasions now we've got two businesses that have been fairly adversely affected, and we ought to try to at least do something. I don't have all the answers, but we ought to think long and hard about this, in my view. And then beyond that, we've got the financial issues to think about, but I think also for the metropolitan climate, if you will, literally hundreds of trucks moving through the Twin City urban areas every day is not an attractive thing. And I think from the standpoint of just public purpose, there's that public purpose we ought to think about as well in terms of just that urban climate and what we want it to be. And generally speaking, downtown areas of our larger cities or any city for that matter, I don't think to the extent we can, we ought to avoid that kind of major league truck traffic to the extent possible, and hopefully maybe we can help these people in some fashion. I don't have the answers, but we ought to look.
Great. Thank you. And Senator Kent, you'll have the final word.
Very quickly. So where...
Well, Senator Metzen, you'll have the final word, but Senator Kent.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what is the game plan here with a week in session? What are we talking about with this bill?
Well, we're going to, specifically with the bill itself, we're going to lay it on the table, you know, in terms of procedurally. I think we've had a good discussion, probably maybe gained some creative ideas, maybe a little more movement around these thoughts than we had had previously. You know, then Senator Metzen and I and others can go talk to our leadership, say, you know, there's a sense that we need to take a look at this, and I don't know. I don't have a good answer. Sorry.
That's as much better than what I understood before right. You said that. And just a very quick follow-up. Mr. Perry, you had mentioned that research and work had been done to come to this figure. I think it would be helpful to see some of the details that contribute to how we got to this number.
Very good.
Before final decisions get made.
Yeah, that would be important, that we're not just pulling numbers out of the air, that we have, I think the term was auditable numbers, so that we're not just writing checks blindly. And I see Mr. Perry nodding that is a good idea. Senator Metzen, final word.
I just really want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, to let us air this concern. I mean, it's a big issue, and hopefully we can find some relief. And I know we can look at all areas where we could look for some resources, but I think they have, in my opinion, a legitimate issue here, and I think we ought to try to continue to keep working on it and get to some conclusion if we can.
I do want to say something for the record. I apologize for stealing the last word, but there had been some suggestion at some point earlier this year that these dollars would be taken from Minneapolis's LGA allocation. That is a very bad and destructive and divisive suggestion, and I just want to say that is not helpful to put things
Chairman,
like that out.
Chairman, as the author of the bill, I've heard that, and that's not the right way to
Great.
Go.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you very much. This has been an excellent hearing. I really appreciate everyone's time and attention. All right. Let's jump to Metro Transit, Light Rail Transit, fare compliance. And I should mention that even though the GOP is not caucusing here at 10, I don't actually know what you're doing in terms of caucusing before session. The DFL is caucusing at 10 across the hall, so at some point we need to move ourselves over there. But we'll try to give this as a full and free and fair open discussion, but in the time that we have. Welcome, Chief Harrington, former Senator Harrington. Glad to have you with us today.
Mr. Chair, it's my pleasure to be here before you to talk about the Metro Transit Light Rail Transit 2015 fare compliance audit.
Okay, please proceed as you see fit.
I believe you've been handed the slides from the PowerPoint presentation we have. To give you some background, Metro Transit Light Rail Fare Payment System is a proof of payment system, and it's a barrier-free system. What that means is rather than constructing turnstiles or fencing, what we depend on is that people will either use their fare media to tag when they get on the platform, and that the way we ensure that is by having officers check their fares on a regular basis and create that environment which says if you do not pay your fare, there's a significant likelihood that you're going to be caught. And that the fine, if you are caught, is significant enough to make it well in your best interest to simply pay the fare. The fare structure for light rail is the same as a non-express bus, which means that the regular fare is about $1.75 with peak going up to $2.25. The way people pay their fare, typically we use a wide variety of different media. For example, if you ride a bus, you can get a paper transfer, and that will be good on light rail also. If you have a digital media, a go-to cart, which is, for example, the 6,000 senior high school students in Minneapolis have, you can simply tag that digital media in. If you're a U of M student, you may have a U-Pass, which simply says if you're going from East Bank to West Bank, you get to ride for free. And then there are a variety of special categories, disabled disabled vets, on-duty firefighters who are allowed to ride for free simply by showing their work ID or their disabled veteran status cards. Currently, only Metro Transit police officers or only licensed police officers in the state of Minnesota can really perform fare inspections. Any officer could issue the tag for a fare violation, but only Metro Transit officers are, in fact, empowered to do the fare inspections. When we find someone, and we find people on a regular basis not paying their fare, we do issue either a warning or a citation, and in, almost 800 times this year alone, we have made arrests. The arrestable offense typically involves something beyond simply the fare evasion. It's usually someone who has narcotics, has a weapon, or in a real recent occasion, they had four felony warrants when we ran their name, in addition to being non-compliant with the fare. We requested the light rail audit because we had the green line that opened last June. Excuse me. And what I wanted to do was create a baseline for this new line that was opening. We knew that from 2008, there was an audit done for Blue Line, and we knew that at that time, they had a fare evasion rate of about 6%. I wanted to see where that rate was for Green Line, excuse me, and also wanted to get a better sense as to where we might have any inefficiencies in our system. So we made the request actually to do the fare study because I wanted to get as much information as possible so that the officers we had hired and were putting on the trains could do the best job possible. The most recent study, as I said, conducted by the unit by a professor at the U of M, estimated the overall evasion rate at 0.55% on weekdays and 0.7% on weekends. An internal police audit of this shows that the fare evasion rate runs between 1% and 0.7% 2014 to 2015. The current audit that we used was a snapshot of a particular time and a particular place on the Green Line to try and figure out what was our fare evasion rate. And one of the things I will note is we asked for them to do it in the fall because that is, in fact, our peak time. With U of M, Minneapolis school kids going back to school, Gopher football, Viking football, lots of special events. The fall is really our heaviest traffic time during the year. At other times of the year, that ridership does fluctuate. And so to be able to use the fare evasion rate that the audit came up with and say, well, we can simply multiply that by 12 and come up with an annualized fare evasion rate is actually not really accurate. According to the audit that was published, Metro Transit may have lost as much as $28,000 per week due to fare evasion for that 1 month. And as I said, to say that that is an accurate or that you can annualize that, I think, is inaccurate due to fluctuations and also due to the fact that what they were really checking were how many people that had to pay the fare did pay the fare. It really didn't count, for example, all of the folks that were disabled vets or other people that had legitimate free fares, the U of M students that had U-passes, the folks that didn't use regular transit cards. They really weren't included in that population. It was really the people that were outside of that population, which are the occasional riders and the normal commuters. We want to also note that as the system was being built, there was a pretty healthy conversation about how would we check on fare enforcement. This is not a new conversation for us. It came up before when the Blue Line was built originally. That precedes my time there. But it has come up regularly as a point of conversation as to, well, should you have a barrier system in place? I will tell you that in my conversations with my colleagues from Chicago, which has a barrier system, New York that has a barrier system, and L.A., which is experimenting with a barrier system in a limited fashion, what they say is that their evasion rate is about 3%. Which is about the same evasion rate that we're getting without the $45 million in capital costs that L.A. put into theirs to get to 3%. So the Blue Line, which is currently at 3%, it started at 6%. Eventually, through education, enforcement, and good engineering, it went down to 3%. It is about the same evasion rate that cities that have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars putting up a barrier system achieve at much greater costs, and frankly, an ongoing cost with those systems also, because it is not simply enough to say we can put up a gate, because given ADA, given folks that are handicapped, the gate system has to be monitored. It has to have someone that can let people in that are in wheelchairs or are handicapped that can't use the barrier system. And oftentimes you're going to need someone there to sell or collect the fares if you're going to have that kind of a barrier system. So it is not simply the capital cost that's involved. There's also a human cost that's also involved in that. The audit recommendations were really twofold for my purposes. First of all, that Metro Transit Police should review and revise our current fare enforcement strategy. And we agreed. That was, in fact, the point of the audit, was that I wanted to have the information necessary to figure out what would be the areas where we should revise our strategy. So, for example, we discovered as part of the audit that many of the part-time officers who work for me, and we have about 90 part-time officers, were not as experienced using the validators. The validators are a little, almost looks like a flip phone for those of us that are old enough to remember flip phones. And it scans a digital media to tell you whether or not the person actually has tagged their digital media or whether they simply have got it to wave it in their hands. We've discovered that our part-time officers were not as well trained on that, and as a consequence, we had some leakage there because they didn't know how to operate the device. They would go up to someone and say, "Do you have your card?" They would say, "Yes, I have a card." They'd show them the card, and they would walk on by rather than to check to see did they actually use that card to make a payment. We also discovered that at special events, and we do an enormous number of special events, that we were checking on the front end. As people were going to the Gopher game, we were checking as they were going to the Vikings game, we were checking as they were going to the Twins game or the concert, but we weren't checking as they left. Well, that's a pretty major leakage because, in fact, we expect them to pay both ways. The length of a normal football game is longer than a transfer would allow you to be there, and so one of the things that we have done as a result of the audit is now that we check both at the front end of the game and the back end of the game, and so we're making sure that the 12,000 people that ride with us to a Vikings game pay both ways on their trip. So we have taken to heart the issues that the audit brought us in terms of our fare evasion or our fare policy, and we've also looked at one of the recommendations that we should do more saturation details. And so we have also already done several saturation details where we have brought double the number of normal officers who work on fare evasion checks and on patrolling the light rail system and brought them to particular stations and then essentially blanketed the station so that everyone gets checked in a very short period of time. Something that we couldn't do on a day-to-day basis, but something we can do using overtime or directed patrol. It also talked about that we needed to do a better job of educating riders who use electronic fare passes about why tagging on the light rail system is important. And that's an ongoing process that we want to do. We believe it is important because one of the concerns I got right as the Green Line launched from community, from students, from schools was, well, you assume we all know how to ride the LRT because the LRT has been operated in Minneapolis. Those of us who call St. Paul home know that St. Paul is St. Paul and Minneapolis is not. And as a consequence, many of the St. Paul folks were not as well educated in terms of how to operate LRT as we would have liked. And so we created a policy with them that says we will operate under a first-time warning system, but we will collect the data on first-time warning so that what happens today and every day, literally, is you get on the train, one of the officers checks you. You do not have the fare. They will then escort you off the train or instruct you to get off the train and pay the fare, but they will also collect your name and date of birth. The next time the officer stops you, they will check your name in our data bank. And if we find that you have not paid the fare in the past, then their instructions are to tag you, not just warn you further. And if you are a multiple, you're a scofflaw, you're a multiple repeat offender, then their instructions are to arrest you and detain you for that violation rather than simply allow you to go on your way. So we did take those things to heart, but we do believe that part of what we're doing is part of the educational process also. As I said, the light rail fare compliance audit did estimate that we might be losing as much as $28,000 per week, which would extrapolate to $1.4 million annually, between $800,000 and $1.4 million annually. We really do not believe that this necessarily reflects our seasonal ridership. And we believe that really that's at the high end, not really a true average number. And so we looked at the what we call in policing the three E's of good police work. Can we engineer a problem out of existence? Can we enforce our way out of the problem? And can we educate out of the problem? We looked at the engineering part of this. If we were to try to retrofit a barrier system to the current existing operation, we estimate that this would cost in excess of $100 million in capital costs. We would have to do several things that are pretty onerous. For example, the platforms as they are currently configured would have to eat up more streetscape, because we'd have to widen the platforms in order to allow for gates and barrier systems, which would mean we would take up more driving lanes or parking lanes along University Avenue and along other major thoroughfares. That would be problematic. The other alternative to that would be to actually buy more property and lengthen the platform so that you could put gates at both ends and then fence the property. But once again, that means buying more physical property, cutting down the lane width for transportation going north and south across the barrier system. There is an issue around safety there. When I talk to my counterparts, once again, in Chicago and New York, they talk about, well, as I said, they have about a 3% leakage rate in terms of people evading the fare even there. But if you're going to evade the fare in Chicago and New York, it means you hop the turnstile. And if you're young and athletic and a great sprinter, you can probably do that without causing yourself orthopedic injuries. If you are not young and athletic and you stumble and you chip your teeth and break your head as you're trying to hop over the turnstile, someone is going to be responsible, and you're on public property, and I can probably tell you that the lawyers at Met Council would get a call, or at least risk management would at that point. There is that issue of ADA. Would we need 24-hour station attendants to make sure that folks that have wheelchairs can get in out of the property if we had a barrier system? In addition to that, there is also the additional maintenance costs, because unlike California, where it never rains, apparently, the snow, the rain, and everything else would impact the barrier system, and it would have to be replaced periodically. We did look at an enforcement option. Given the number of LRT trains currently in existence, we estimate that if we were to run, right now, Blue Line runs 18 hours a day, Green Line runs 24 hours a day. For me to staff two officers on every car of every three-car concerts or train system, I would need an additional 350 officers to do that. That would amount to an annual cost of about $45 million in ongoing costs for the additional officers. We could cheapen that somewhat by doing what Dallas does. Dallas has private security that does, they have 50 dedicated private security people that does their fare checks. That costs Dallas, we believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of about $30 million to be able to staff that 24/7 also. So it is still a significant ongoing labor cost that we would have to look at. And we should also note that this number really only reflects the current rail operations. As Botno Bay and Southwest and other lines continue to be developed over the years, we would have to add those same costs to that, to those systems also. The conversation we had internally with the general manager and with the management team was to recover $1 million, what is reasonable and prudent on a return on investment? What's our ROI on trying to recover $1 million? Assuming that 3% is the baseline that everyone is going to have as leakage, what could we really hope to accomplish at the high end? And we thought that what really seemed reasonable was some additional enforcement activities, some additional educational opportunities, but we needed to be prudent about the public dollar and not spend $45 million to get $1 million back. We certainly didn't think that spending $100 million to get the $1 million back was a prudent use of the public dollars. We thought that something less than that would be prudent, and my direction was to start working on those things as soon as possible. Currently, I will give you the current fare compliance checks. In 2014, with 6 months of Green Line and 12 months of Blue Line, we did 1,300,000 fare checks. Those were the person-to-person contacts that police officers from Metro Transit had with customers on the system. Of that 6,346 were non-paying first-time offenders, and we escorted them off the train. Of that 6,000, 15, almost 1,600 of them came back for a second bite of the apple, and we tagged or arrested them. This averaged out on Green Line to being about 110 violations that were arrested per month during the first 6 months of Green Line, and about 70 on the Blue Line. Blue Line had a higher voluntary or had a lesser noncompliance rate. Thus far, year-to-date and up to April of 2015, we have fare-checked 470,000 people. We project that we will fare-check 1.5 million people this year. So we expect that we will fare-check more people. Partly that is a function of adding additional officers, which we recognize that we needed to have in order to really police a 24/7 operation. What we recognize is that the number of officers we had really, if we're going to put them in pairs, and frankly, putting them in pairs is the most prudent public safety act way of deploying them, then we needed more officers in order to meet even our minimal threshold that we have right now. Of that 470,000 people that were checked, 2,598 non-paying customers were escorted off the train, which is a significant increase from what we had last year by one quarter. If we were to extrapolate for an entire year there, we would be escorting 10,000 people off of the train over the course of this year for non-payment. We've already issued 796 tickets and or made arrests at an approximate fine of about $180 per ticket is what the general fine payable is for a no-pay fare ticket. Given our standards in terms of looking at who pays from the people that we have checked, we're at about a 0.7 fare evasion rate rather than the 3-6 rate that the study would show. What we're seeing is Green Line increasingly fit into the same level of compliance that Blue Line is. Blue Line started out at 6 and eventually got down to 3. Green Line started out anywhere from, if you look at this study, at 9, at the high end, 6 potentially at the low end, and it is very quickly getting closer to 4 and 5 in terms of its compliance rate as we engineer, enforce, and educate the public about the process there. Are there questions?
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Chief Senator, for your report. I'm wondering if, I spoke with family members last night about this, that we were going to hear this. I have family members that live around the country, and they were right on board with what you're saying here, that sometimes the enforcement costs more than the losses. But I'm wondering if there's a difference in losses. For instance, my perception is the Blue Line comes from the Mall of America, the airport, the VA, and then there's more of a destination that's closer to downtown, so there's several stops in between. Do you find when you're doing the study and the checking of fares that somebody hopped on to go to the next stop? They get on at Snelling and go to Raymond, or they get on right out here by the Capitol just to get downtown, and they don't bother with paying the fare because it's so short. And even if they get caught, they get kicked off at the destination that they're headed to in the first place. Do you find that there's a difference between the lines like that? And do you ask the question what their destination is when you check their fare?
Mr. Chair?
Chief Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator. We do, in fact, see that there is a significant difference in terms of the ridership habits of Blue Line versus Green Line. As you know, the Blue Line oftentimes seems to be much more of a destination from downtown Minneapolis to the Mall of America or to the VA, from Mall of America to the baseball diamonds or to the football fields. So we do see a difference there, and the Green Line has seemed to be more of a less of a straight commuter line and more of an urban transportation system, where we see folks that get on it downtown who are only getting to the Capitol, or we see folks that are getting on it downtown that are only getting to Snelling. Because of that, we have been able to use crime analysis to pinpoint where our high boarding and high departures are, and we've also been able to pinpoint where our high fare evasion points are. Snelling Avenue is, in fact, probably our highest fare evasion point. The U of M is our highest departure and boarding point. I believe Westgate or East Bank is, I think, the highest point. I think they got to a million faster than anybody else did. Because we know where folks are getting off most frequently and where we have our highest rates of evasion, we have stationed additional officers for our saturation details and for our plainclothes details at those areas to try and increase the chances of catching folks that are, in fact, doing exactly what you described, jumping on at one point, hoping that they're not going to get caught because it's a short ride. But we're catching a significant number of those folks also. So we do believe that while the two are different, our strategies for Green Line have mirrored what we've experienced and what we continue on a monthly basis. We look at LRT crime patterns, boarding patterns, and fare evasion patterns to try and make sure that we can move the cops to the right dots every month.
Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Another question is, are these enforcement officers, thank you, Mr. Chair, are these enforcement officers always uniformed?
Chief Harrington.
Chair, no, our enforcement officers, we use plainclothes enforcement and we do uniform enforcement. We recognize sort of the Hawthorne effect that if we get on a train in uniform, that there are people that will look around and make a decision, I'm not riding that train because I don't want to get checked. And there's at the rate we're checking people, there's a really good chance you're going to get checked if you're on a train and you see a uniform officer. We decided that in order to keep them guessing, plainclothes operations would be a valuable tool to add to that mix. And so we mix in anywhere from 4 to 8 plainclothes operations per month to try and keep them guessing to some extent. We believe that the plainclothes officers also have been very instrumental in helping us eliminate some other quality of life crimes that we see along transit, people drinking, people smoking, things that they would, once again, the Hawthorne effect of the uniform suddenly causes you to sit up and fly right. The non-uniform officers have less of a deterrent effect, but they do get the word around pretty quickly that if you do something on the train, you are likely to get caught. Finally, the last piece of that puzzle for transit police is that we have 6,000 cameras when you count all of the cameras on all of the cars and all of the trains and all of the platforms. And so we are able to go back and historically recreate areas. So when people call to complain about something that happened there, we're able to go back and oftentimes recreate the incident and identify, because we have quite literally in some of our platforms high-def video that we're collecting, so good that we've been able to go out and pick people up for robberies, theft of cell phones, things along that line, simply off of the video quality that we have at the transit stations also.
How's the video data classified?
Yes. Right.
Actually, I would like to answer that question. You don't have to answer it now, but that's, you know, we're pretty tuned into those discussions if it's private, non-public, blah, 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 all that stuff. Mm-hmm. We have Senator Kent and Senator Kickmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, thank you. This is a very helpful analysis, and I appreciate it. I appreciate that the analysis that you've done is very much based on the direct costs and benefits in terms of the return on the investment, relative return on the investment of different options. A question I have has to do with the indirect costs. I've been paying close attention to the planning and development for the Gold Line, the Gateway Corridor that'll go out through your neighborhood, out towards mine in Woodbury. And one of the things that they've talked about is the efficiencies and the overall cost efficiency of the line based on ridership and ease of use, and the fact that when you have things like this type of payment system, it makes it easier, quicker for people to get on and for the vehicles to go faster and not have to be stopped so long while people are fumbling for change like you do on a traditional bus. And that's been part of why that optimizes that overall equation in terms of efficiencies. Is that discussed as well when you're talking about the type, whether or not the barrier systems would be effective or considered?
Chief Harrington.
Chair, Senator Kidd. No, I do not believe that was in the purview of the audit as it was set up. It is part of the conversation we have with Charles Carlson of Small Starts and others as we are planning for enforcement and fair compliance checks on the Gold Line, the Red Line, and the other BRT systems. It is, in fact, very much something we recognize. One of the unintended consequences of even following the audit's recommendations. For example, the first Twins game of this year, we began checking both at the front end and the back end. Well, one of the things that happened with that was we ended up stacking up the line of people trying to get on because we were checking every fare to the point that they were basically pushed out into the street, which required us to bring in other officers to make sure that the traffic could be controlled around them as we stacked up the line. What we subsequently did with that for all games since then is we doubled up the number of officers who were doing fare checks at the front end to speed up the rate that they could get on rather than back them up into the streets. We recognize that a barrier system would have that same effect, though, because it would require each person to stop as they go on, rather than simply to tag the football, as it's called in our parlance, as you go on. Swiping is far quicker than trying to figure out where your change is, where your card is, things along that lines.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chief Harrington.
Just maybe Senator Carlson, microphone can be
okay,
pointed.
Thank you.
Great.
Yeah, mainly for the record, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chief Harrington. Very, very.
Well, just speak loudly.
All right.
It'll pick
so.
Up.
Yeah, thank you. Again. So I appreciate this is very, very helpful to have this kind of factual information. And I think it is appropriate for us to do a compliance cost benefit. I mean, our goal is to have a high rate of compliance because it's just fair to everybody that those who pay are not robbed by those who don't. The other thing is that we are all safer because the tendency is for if you have somebody who is cheating in this area, they may be cheating in other areas, and I think it puts a general public safety is strengthened. I do kind of like the idea of having the presence of the officers because I think there's value there beyond having just the barriers. And I do understand that getting quickly on or off is a unique aspect of that. But I also think that word travels. If it's easy to cheat, word travels. Hey, don't sweat it. Just hop on. The likelihood of you being caught is very unlikely. And so if you have 6% and you continue in that laxness, you will have a higher percent. It's just logical. It's just the dynamic of the human function. So the one thing that I do have is that I think it is fair to talk about this in an upfront design, making sure that we consider this, not just say, oh, well, we're just going to have a system that doesn't. I think whether it's the officer presence or you have a technology that is used or whatever it is, that it be considered. And I think that whatever method, whether it's a personal presence or if you have a technology or whatever it is, that it just be part of the normal process of conducting our business. So I appreciate your suggestions and your education and all of those things that are part of this. I think it's been very, very helpful. Any future entities, certainly. But I think the biggest thing is if you have a general laxity, you will encourage it. And you will have other violations that go along with it because of the overall attitude. And I think those that do pay should be able to freely get on and freely get off without a big hindrance, and so that's always kind of a balance, but I appreciate the report. I thought it was interesting, though, that your ongoing efforts here have shown that there was a laxness. I mean, just the fact that your number of tickets and number of people escorted off or all of that goes to show that there was a trend line, a rather serious trend line, that because of the previous times laxness and just kind of having this trust, that you saw an escalation. Now you've stopped that, and I think that's good. But I would feel more likely to travel knowing that there is a greater enforcement, because I know that with one area of violation, there can be others as well, and I think it increases safety overall. But I really appreciate the opportunity to hear, and thank you for your diligence in this regard on behalf of all of us.
So we do need to wrap up very, very quickly, and I have one remaining question of my own. So if we could do like lightning round, quick question, quick answer for Senator Newman, Senator Zinjam, myself, and then we'll get out of here. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be quick. Chief, good to see you again. It sounds to me like you have implemented some new strategies as a result of the audit, and subject to an invitation by the chair, I would request that you come back and talk to us again next year and give us an update on how you're doing. But I really do appreciate you coming in this morning. You have answered almost all of my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Zinjam.
And I'll be quick, too. Kudos to you, Chief, and thanks for being here and your report. I personally have never had much of a problem being checked, so I never really had too much of concern about this. For instance, last week even, Senator Rood Weber and I went downtown Minneapolis one evening to have dinner, and were checked on both routes. But I did have one real specific question. If, for instance, I'm coming back from Minneapolis and I have 20 minutes left on my card and I know that it's a half-hour trip, what are the rules there? You get on and let your card expire, or you just buy a new card?
Chief Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator Zinjam, the appropriate activity would be to buy a new fare if you know that your fare is going to expire.
Okay.
We give the officers the discretion, though, to be realistic about someone who was not trying to cheat the system, and they were within minutes of being able to reach their destination with an appropriate transfer. So we allow the officers to have reasonable discretion to be able to find out what was going on in this person's behavior. If this is a person who has repeatedly demonstrated that they're in noncompliance, the benefit of the doubt is probably not going to be given.
Okay, thanks. Senator Carlson says he has three more questions. We're already over time, so let's go quick.
Simple
please.
Ones. The 600 cameras you mentioned you have, are they personally monitored? Are the feeds to all of them recorded? And what do you do with that information? And I guess I'm going to say a fourth one. If you're planning on using facial recognition software, will you come back to us?
Senator Chief Harrington.
The cameras are monitored at RCC primarily for track safety. They are recorded and then re-recorded over unless there is a criminal investigation where we flag the tape for a particular incident where we're doing an investigation. Otherwise, it simply gets recorded over. I don't know what the timeline is on that, on the attention on that. We do not have any plans at this time to move into facial recognition software. I think that's the three questions.
Will you come back to us if you do?
Absolutely, sir.
Thank you.
My
Thank you,
two
Mr. Chair.
Lightning round questions are, I just want to know for the record, I've never been checked. So this whole activity is like an abstract mystery to me. I've literally never been checked on the train, all the many times I've ridden it. Never even seen the checking being done. Number two, what is our goal for compliance? What are we striving to achieve in terms of noncompliance? And third, I want to know just a little bit more about the fines, why they go to the issuing county, what the level of infraction is, and whether or not Metro Transit retains any of the fine dollars. So What is our goal?
I'm sorry you haven't been checked, which I'm surprised you haven't, actually. I've got folks that are checking close to 1,000 people a month in their 20 days of working, so I'm actually very surprised you haven't been checked. I know you do ride regularly.
To officially recognize me on your cameras and then go hunt me down.
My boss, Brian Lamb, has been checked on so many occasions. He's on a first-name basis with my cops, as has Pat Bourne, the regional administrator. So I don't think anyone's getting a bye. And one of my friends who was chief of police in an adjoining county was checked 3 times going to and from the Twins game recently. So
literally
I don't know
never.
That anybody's getting the pass at this point.
Although once I did, because your things weren't working, I called Judd and said, I'm violating the fares. But because it's your fault, you're my witness if I get busted.
In terms of our goal is to get compliance down to around the 3% or less level. I think Blue Line is achieve what we think is a reasonably good level of compliance at 3%. We'd like to see us get Green Line to 3% and then continue to work both on the education, engineering, and enforcement, and to see if we can reduce that even further. But 3% is my current goal to try and get Green Line to. Missing one of the questions. Fines?
The fines, yeah. Like it says they go to the issuing county, it says it's $180. Why does it go to the county? Does Metro Transit get to keep some of those dollars, and what's the level of the offense?
It is a payable. We have now moved to Mr. Chair. The fine is now a payable. We've gotten that worked out with both Ramsey County and Hennepin County, because before it was requiring actually a court appearance because it was a misdemeanor, and that didn't make any sense. So it's now as a payable, so it can be paid simply the same way a traffic ticket can be paid. Currently, we do not have, as a state agency, we do not have a set of agreements in place with the counties where we would get to collect or claw back any of the fair fine revenue they get. And when we've had that discussion with Ramsey and Hennepin County, what we've been indicated is that they also do not charge us, for example, for bookings. And so that there may well be a wash in terms of how much we would recover in fine revenues versus how much we'd have to pay for bookings. But we are looking into whether or not we should be able to collect some portion of that. Dallas has a system where they get to collect a significant amount of the fine revenue, and that's what pays for their private security fare checkers, is they use that revenue for that.
All right. Well, let's explore that thought in the future, or in the near future, maybe in the next week. All right. Thank you. All right. Anything further, members? Great. Excellent. Both discussions were excellent. I really appreciate everyone's attendance and participation. With that, we are adjourned.